Funding for K-12 education has generated plenty of headlines this session, but that's hardly a surprise. It is, after all, a budget year. What has caught some State House watchers off guard is the high volume of education legislation not tied directly to base funding levels and the high volume at which some of those measures have been debated. Hi, I'm John Schwanis, and on this week's program, we'll examine the General Assembly's version of the three R's: retooling the state's accountability standards, rewarding long underpaid teachers, and readying Hoosier students for the workforce of the 21st century. So don't go away. Indiana lawmakers, from the State House to your house.
The Visual Analytics Law Enforcement Toolkit, or VALET, developed at Purdue University, brings critical data and analytics to police departments instantly, so officers are a step ahead of criminal activity. To learn more, visit otc-prf.org.
This year's legislative session has seen the introduction of an unusually wide assortment of education-related measures. Higher salaries for underpaid teachers, state-funded training for teachers who want to carry firearms in schools, more stringent oversight of so-called virtual charter schools, a proposed gateway exam for civics, and inclusion of charter schools in all school referenda dealing with operating expenses. Now, I could go on, as they say, but instead, since we want to actually save some time for discussion, allow me to introduce this week's guests. Republican Representative Bob Banning of Indianapolis, chairman of the House Education Committee. Democratic Representative Greg Porter of Indianapolis, the ranking minority member of the House Ways and Means Committee. Teresa Meredith, president of the Indiana State Teachers Association. And Chris Hemsel, superintendent of Northwest Allen County Schools. Thank you for letting me get through that with a frog in my throat, too. I appreciate that. Superintendent, you drove the farthest, so we'll let you start. What could the General Assembly do this session that would improve your life, ease your headaches, and those of the 7,000-plus students that you have in your district?
Well, you know, when we take a look back to 2009, when the state legislature took over the school funding formula, and we no longer had the local property taxes included with that, if we could make movement towards getting back to keeping up with inflation with that time, we're currently about 10% below that. The current proposal that's on the table is about 1.5% increase in per student funding. And if we can try to close that gap, that would be a huge help to us as we try to address teacher salaries, as well as try to restore programs for kids that we were having to cut during that recession.
Of course, now when you hear members of the General Assembly talk about it, the numbers, they're pretty proud of what they're able to do with a fairly tight budget. More than 2%, I believe, in basic school funding support in both years of the biennium. Now, that may not
necessarily... 2% over total funding, but total it's only 1.5% in per student funding. And that 1.5% and percent in per student funding is what makes a difference for us to each and
each
of the kids.
Right.
So,
but we are appreciative of anything that we get, granted. But we're trying to get to the point where we're trying to recover from that recession and get our salaries as well as programs for kids back.
And that's a good thing you're obliged to say that when you're in the presence of the House Education Committee chairman. How do you respond to that?
I think we also recognize that we want to drive more money in the classrooms. It's not no secret that Representative Houston and I reached out to Teresa and to Dan Holub, the executive director of ISTA, early in the summer to talk about how do we do more to try to drive money to the classroom. I mean, we think that's a real focus. And we think, obviously, we want to put more money in the formula. That's a critical component. But if you look at the period of time, just within the last 6 years, we put almost $700 million in, and we have some teachers that have had salary increases in 8 years. So how do we, just putting money in the formula does not guarantee that you're going to get money to the classroom.
So those are all decisions that are made at the
local decisions
level through collective bargaining agreements. And that is, I guess, part of the $64,000 question about how to ensure that even if money is in the pipeline, how it gets into the pockets of teachers. Do you think that the percentage that we where we are right now is likely to be what goes to the governor in the end? Or, of course, I always say that you really don't know until the right. April revenue update.
You're right. It's about to forecast. I think, you know, when you look at the whole situation, 2.2% 2020 and 2.1% in 2021 for increase, which my colleagues always say this is the most we've ever given, you know, in regards to public education. But as the superintendent said, the recession of 2009 and $300 million that was taken away in 2010, we could do a lot better. And when we talk about how much money we've given or the percentages, that's just the overall percentages. I mean, there are some schools that are doing very well, and there are other schools that are not. I think we calculate 109 schools, school corporations, over the next biennium will lose dollars.
And it's all based on student enrollment. I think it's probably in 9 or 10 and 11, we decided 11, 12, to really focus on dollars following the kids. So regardless of where they are, we were having problems. Hamilton Southeastern, for instance, historically was always losing money, even though they were growing in enrollment per pupil. So the foundation is equal across the state. So the school districts that are actually losing money are schools that have declining enrollment. Unfortunately, there's a number of those, if you look in our rural areas, that are struggling because the demographics show that more people are moving towards your communities of interest, like your major metropolitan areas. They want quality of life, employment, those things pull people together.
And enrollment is determined at the outset of the school year, so you may have people who come or go, but that is set. How do you feel, and how do your associates in the union feel at this point, Teresa? Is it... It appears to be better than we might have thought a few months mm-hmm. ago because there was a miscalculation in some of the early budgeting. Mm-hmm. A good kind of mistake, I guess, when you can come up with a few more million
lots more millions of
dollars. Is it close to what you want to see yet?
It's getting there. It's headed in the right direction. We think that there's more progress that can be made in order for it to be a genuine step in the right direction. We appreciate that everyone seems to be acknowledging that it is an issue, but it's everybody's issue. It's not just Republican. It's not just Democrat. It is everybody's issue if our local community schools aren't funded and supported in a way that they can sustain programs and then talk about how they're going to increase salaries for their teachers. So it really is a conversation that everybody needs to be a part of, and everybody needs to be a part of the solution. So we appreciate being part of the conversations, but we don't believe we're where we need to be yet. There needs to be a little bit more, and we'd like to see something actually committed to teacher pay increases. Not something that's off the bargaining table, but a committed amount of money that a local school district would have to put on that bargaining table.
You know, well, they won't have to. I mean, but public pressure presumably would encourage them to do so. Well,
and the bargaining teams, you know, but that pension piece that the governor, the offset
right,
piece that the governor's offered,
$70 million
it would be
a year
really nice if that somehow came with a caveat so that school districts would have to use that money, would have to put that on the table, and then negotiate how it's spent, whether it go to benefits
well,
like insurance
to do,
or
whether
it go to salary.
It down.
Yeah.
So, I mean, will you spend the money if you get the $70 million? I know it's not across the board even figure. But
we're basically in a teacher shortage situation. We're struggling to find enough quality candidates. It is in our best interest to put as much money towards salaries as we can, and we've been doing that. Since 2012, the per-student funding for our particular district has been keeping up with inflation. It's that gap from 2009 to 2012 that we haven't recovered from. We're now getting to the point where in our district is close enough to Michigan and Ohio that we're starting to see teachers consider going to Ohio and Michigan because those states have been putting more money towards that. Because of that, we have been trying to maximize money to the classroom as much as we can. It's in our best interest to raise teacher salaries as much as we can so that we're competitive, and we've been doing that.
What is your average, can you ballpark it right now, what the average teacher salary is?
Our average teacher salary is a little over $51,000.
So when we hear a lot of the horror stories, I guess if you want to be dramatic, about $30,000 or less in some parts of the state, that's not the situation that you're...
Well, and especially when you go back to 2009-10 and you look at the state of Indiana, I think we were around $55,000 as a statewide average at that particular time. For about 100 years, from the 1880s up into the early 1990s, the national teacher average compared to the personal income per member of our labor force was about 80 to 85%. It was always in that range. In 2014-15, we're down to 60%. All the way up from the 60s all the way up through the early 2000s, we had been in a situation where in Indiana, we had been in and around the national average in teacher salaries. we are now 86% of what the national average is. So not only is the national teacher salary down to 60% of the per personal income for member of the labor force, which had traditionally been 80 to 85%, Indiana's dropped from being right around that national average to only being about 86% of that national average.
But when you talk about teacher pay averages, you also have to talk about points in time. We've done a really good job in Indiana bringing up that base. Not every beginning teacher is at a good, strong place yet. I'd love to see every beginning teacher at least make $40,000, but that's still not the case in Indiana. Done a pretty good job, not quite there yet. Yeah. But it's those the points throughout your career. So if you look at a five-year average or a 10-year teacher average, what are those salaries looking like? And when they're still looking like that base salary, something's not right with the way the system's either being funded, executed, or all of the above.
Back a little bit, Stanford Children, Teach Plus, and ISC actually released, I think it was Stanford Children and Teach Plus did a report that was released back in January. And one of the things that that actually reflected on is that if you look at the percent of money going to teachers over the 40 years period of time compared to administration is actually almost flipped. So if you look at the dollars, it has not gone as much into the classroom and more money of it's gone to administrative salaries. So how do we equalize that or get more equity back? And that was one of the reasons we looked at House Bill 1003, because we were trying to provide more clarity so that when they go to the bargaining table, they know a little bit more about what's going on in the schools in terms of finances, and we're trying to direct more money into that educational account instead of into the administration.
We as Democrats, we propose a minimum of $40,000 that was said earlier, and so we understand that in order to keep the talent that you have in the next 3 to 4 years, particularly young teachers, they come in, they have the loans due, and then they stay 2 or 3 years and they move on and go other places. But we understand to create those dollars to help them to stay in the classroom so we can continue to keep a pipeline of educators, young educators, innovative educators, to move forward.
And I know you had offered members of the caucus proposed floor amendments, or they were 4 amendments that were proposed and were rejected. Why not specify? And I know it's not tradition. I know that's not the way we've done things in Indiana. But why not say, this is what the pot of money is, and
this is what the minimum salary is. Number one, we did not want to get in a position where we're setting a statewide salary schedule. I think that really is a local decision.
Even though some states do, but
some, of course, but most don't. Right. And we have collective bargaining, which is supposed to help pull that money together. We believe that, number one, we don't want to be the state school board for everybody. So local communities know what's best. I actually, last Monday, a week ago Monday, ISTA had several of their teachers come in from Region 12, I think it was.
And one of them, Region 7.
Okay, 7. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
One of the numbers. Anyway, I was actually talking to one of the teachers who happens, I did her wedding flowers when she got married, and her mother is my wife's best friend. Anyway, she was telling me that they had foregone a salary increase because they had a program that they really wanted to fund in their school, as opposed to maybe having more money in their base pay. I know IPS, for instance, when they negotiate, they may decide that they want a paraprofessional in every classroom, and the teachers together come together and say, let's work together. This is what we would rather have. So saying it's going to be $40,000 is very difficult, and how do you guarantee that every teacher is going to get $40,000 when those local decisions are made to use that educational resources in maybe a little bit different way than what.
But I think if we're serious, though, about addressing what I would call a teacher crisis, if we're really serious about that, we may have to think outside the box about what it looks like to stabilize the profession. In the early 70s, we were in crisis in terms of teacher placement. There weren't enough educators. People weren't staying. You couldn't see what your pay trajectory was. And so they created this thing called the salary schedule and a formula. And then you could tell what life might be like if you did the job and did it well and you progressed in the profession. You knew you weren't going to get rich, but you could at least have a decent living, and students benefit by that. When there's stability in a school building, in the staffing, we have data that supports that students achieve far more. There's such stability and calm that comes with that predictability of staff, and I think that's a point that we need to remember when we're talking about what we need to be doing to address this teacher crisis. Our students need that stability.
I also want to push back a little bit on the administrative pay aspect of things. We have increased administrative cost. We now have people devoted to doing nothing but taking care of testing so that teachers can teach and administrators can deal with parents and teach and support teachers and students.
And don't forget promotion.
We're not doing the PR and the promotion in our particular district, but it's something we have to think about and consider.
A lot of districts are.
But we've doubled the number of state reports since 2008. So now we have two people who do nothing but data to do that. We've increased people who do the attendance officers. We've increased their hours and got them wages because we have to make sure our reports to the state are correct. And so they're doing work that they've never been asked to do until the legislature asks us to do these additional reports and these additional testing. And there's a domino effect to all these costs that ends up having other people not spend time in the classroom but doing all this administrivia. And we need more people to get that kind of stuff done.
Administrivia. That's a good word.
One thing was said, Bob said, we don't want to be the state school board. And we are. General Assembly, over the years since we've been there, we have mandated and said, thou shalt do all these action items. And without it being funded, and that's one thing the superintendent's talking about.
Well, you gave me a perfect segue, jumping off point, when you talked about the need to process this data so that the state has it for report cards. And you talked about the General Assembly increasingly serving, almost acting as a board. So one of the controversies, thank you for the segue, of course, is the debate over accountability measures. We've had now over the past 10 years how many, a lot of different versions and a lot of different tests and a lot of different approaches about what is being measured, what the metrics are. And I guess a bit of a controversy, or at least some debate this session, was the General Assembly's desire to perhaps move toward new standards that focus on postgraduate performance in the workplace as opposed to standardized test scores, even though that doesn't seem to sit well necessarily with the superintendent of public instruction and members of the board who had already sort of moved in another direction. How do you sort through that?
Well, first off, I think in terms of assessment, going back to that, we really have not changed directions over the last, since NCLB passed. NCLB,
No
Child Left Behind, ended up, requiring assessments. And Indiana, actually, under Governor Bayh, had started ISTEP, I think it was. We may have changed the name at one point in time. So we had been assessing language arts, math, and science, for several decades.
But hasn't it fluctuated? I mean, certain things have been emphasized, different tests. We've certainly seen
different. We've changed. Over the period of time, there's been different vendors. ISTEP has consistently been the test up until we had CTB McGraw-Hill for a majority of the time was a vendor. Under Superintendent Ritz, there were several issues that we had with the test. So they went out for an RFP. They have a new vendor now. We did change, and now we've gone to iLearn. This will be the first administration to a new test.
Well, is it time, though, to get something else? Or do you think teachers already are
First off, we have to understand that, number one, I think a number of us believe accountability is not inappropriate, but federal law does require, even under every Student Succeeds Act still requires testing in language, arts, math, and science. If you want federal money, we get about $600-700 million a year in title money. They require assessment. So every state in the union is still assessing on that.
But how Indiana uses that assessment has really morphed into something that is really almost a monster. It's no longer just for the national accountability. It's no longer just for information to inform instruction. It's for teacher evaluation. It's for school letter grade. It's all these different things that it's used for. And I'm not so sure that is the best use of that data.
Change, those letter grades. Yeah. I mean,
letter grades change. We talk about the growth model. I can remember one year in General Assembly, the governor, the superintendent, and Representative Bain, they all had their own concept, and it was like a melting pot of nothing until we came out with where we are right now. It's very difficult.
Is it a moving target? Do you feel that
it is a moving target? We've spent over $30 million a year on ISTEP now, iLearn, and that doesn't include all the local cost. To administer a test that is standardized, and by definition of standardized, about half the kids are going to be above average and about half the kids are going to be below average. That's never going to change. That didn't change back in 1988 when we started with IPASS. Mm-hmm. When we went to 3, 6, 8, and 10, when we now grade everything from 3 through 8 in the high school, nothing has changed from the standpoint that a standardized test identifies kids on where they fall on a curve compared to other kids. And about half of those kids will be above average, and half of those kids will be below average.
So you're saying it's almost pointless?
And so we've been chasing a dream of having all kids be above average, and mathematically that's not possible. Here's the reality. We spent over $30 million on a test that we don't do anything with. A quality of a school is not the score of a child. It's what you do with the information to make learning better for kids. And we get zero information from iStep that is useful. So we spend another amount of money to do an NWEA test to find out the strengths of our kids and the weaknesses of our kids that inform instruction for our teachers after spending $30 million to get zero information that's useful and helpful.
Bob Boehning, respond to that, and then I want to move on to, we do have so many other topics.
Number one, the Fed.
This is a survey course today. We're just kind of touching a little bit here. And a little
hit or miss.
The Feds still do require summative tests. The NWEA is not a test. It's a benchmark or interim assessment, which is what he's talking about, using NWEA, which is just one vendor, is not acceptable under federal accountability. I think there has been historically real problems, and that's one reason why we did away with iStep, with the value of the data. But it's not really to use to inform instruction. It's really used to have a reflection back, looking at the past year. Maybe these are some of the critical components that we missed in our instruction. These are things that I need to emphasize next year when I move forward. We do fund, the state of Indiana actually is paying for his interim or benchmark test in WEA. And in fact, we had a bill we moved this session that will actually ask the department to line predictability so there will be some predictive power. Because frequently I hear from superintendents, my kids take NWEA, has no reflection at all how they're doing on iStep. And if we're going to give an interim or benchmark assessment, which is supposed to inform instruction and supposed to be aligned directly to a summative assessment, it ought to be predicting how well they're going to do.
All right. This time I don't have a good segue, but I'm going to switch topics abruptly because we do want to cover a lot. The tension, and it's been building now for a number of years, between public schools, traditional public schools, and I guess we can include charters in that. And then you look at the voucher programs, which I think Indiana's is still probably the largest program in the country in terms of private school vouchers. How would you assess that? Has that, in your estimation, has that lost momentum? I mean, you're sitting across the table here from one of the architects of school choice in the state of Indiana. Do you sense that there's a changing tide? Several of the proposals that would have expanded those sorts of distribution of wealth, you might say, to other schools outside the traditional public realm, seem to meet more opposition than they might have in the past.
Well, I mean, when we look at the data, and we look at even at the form that this came out, we talked 2.1, 2.2%, et cetera, but virtual schools do better than your traditional public schools. The voucher
do
program,
better financially, not necessarily.
Yeah,
in terms
financially.
Of performance.
I mean, the voucher program is exploding. There's more dollars going to the voucher schools. I mean, they have like a 10% increase over the next 2 years versus where we are with traditional public schools. Virtuals. I mean, virtual schools are just. I mean, we have to look at the whole situation, look at everything, and see where we are. You know. Representative Boehning and Houston would say, we're addressing only 8% of the population, or 7% of the schools in virtuals and charters are vouchers, but 93% of the students are getting funded, but it's not funded in the same way.
Superintendent, now, again, we've stipulated earlier that the money follows the student. Have you lost money as students have gone to parochial schools?
In the overall system, the answer is yes. We actually net gain back from the private schools in our particular situation. But, I have five kids, and my wife bakes a pie, and we split it up into seven pieces. When we have a holiday birthday or a holiday that we celebrate, and my mother-in-law comes over, my mom comes over, my brother and his wife and his two kids come over, we don't divide the pie up with more students. We go, or more people, we bake another pie. And what we've done here is that we have about 57% of the students in the voucher program have never been part of the funding formula, but we've never done anything to build another pie in order to help accommodate the fact that we're funding more students.
I thought that was a nice way of telling me you had a piece of pie for me out in the that you cut for me out. I cannot believe we're out of time. As I say, we have just nibbled at the edges of this. Clearly, a lot more we could talk about, but I'm glad we were able to get your insights and your thoughts about what we what is moving forward this session. I appreciate your being here. Again, my guests have been Republican Representative Bob Boehning of Indianapolis, Democratic Representative Greg Porter of Indianapolis, Teresa Meredith, President of the Indiana State Teachers Association, and Chris Hemsel, Superintendent of Northwest Allen County Schools. Friends, Hoosiers countrymen, lend me your ears. And at the end of the month, I'll owe you four ears. Payday loans on the next Indiana Lawmakers. And time now for our weekly conversation with Ed Feigenbaum, publisher of the newsletter Indiana Legislative Insight and its sister publication, Indiana Education Insight, both part of Hanna News Service. During the roundtable, we talked a lot about money. No surprise there, since it makes up more than half of the state budget, K through 12 education, that is. What, besides money, is on the front burner as far as you're concerned, related to education?
There are all kinds of education bills in the House Republican agenda, and most of them have all gone through essentially as they were supposed to earlier this year. I think one of the key issues that's still trying to get resolved, and some of this has to do with money also, is the school safety issue. And you've got some, you have some issues there with the superintendent of public instruction isn't real happy with having to dip into the same fund for things like mental health services for the students and for hardening the schools, what do we do about entrances to the buildings and things like that.
And for training, firearms training. For school officials or teachers.
And her sentiments are shared by many of the superintendents who also want to be able to not have to double dip for the same kinds of things and want to be able to have a little bit more money for things that they feel are better suited to their districts, just like everything else. Everybody wants the local control.
Well, and the concern is it'll be tapped out, right? And even though lawmakers have said they'll replenish it, I guess not if they're not in Indianapolis meeting.
And even though the governor has given more money to the school safety issue over the biennium and over the interim.
Right. Well, we are at the halfway point. What else are you going to be watching in the third and fourth quarters if we break it down that way?
There are going to be some interesting things. I think some things that will provoke controversy, some things just kind of need to be smoothed out. Obviously the bias crimes issue and having the governor weigh in, the business community weigh in is going to be important. You're also going to see a little bit of bumping of heads over the Capital Improvement Board and soccer stadium funding for Indianapolis, although in the first half of the session, we tended not to see the folks from outstate get involved and get upset about that. And gambling will be a big thing. We need to see that take place in the House and have something happen there. There are a few other issues, obviously, that will also come up.
Oh, that Indianapolis-outstate tension never leaves us, does it?
Yeah.
Thank you, Ed. As always, we appreciate your insight. For more information, episode streams, and other extra content, visit us on the web at wfyi.org/lawmakers. You can access live streaming coverage of the General Assembly on the Internet as well. And remember, you can get our show on demand from Xfinity. Well, that concludes another edition of Indiana Lawmakers. I'm John Schwannis, and on behalf of WFYI Public Media, Indiana's other public broadcasting stations, and my colleague Ed Feigenbaum, thank you for joining us, and I invite you to visit WFYI.org for more State House coverage. Until next week, take care.
Purdue researchers are advancing manufacturing industries by developing 3D additive methods, leading through innovation and job creation. Purdue Research Foundation. Contact innovation at prf.org.